next presentation is on the role of hip abductor strengthening in the treatment of patellofemoral pain syndrome. Our presenters are Marilyn and Lisa E. Silas-Impantia, and the supervisor is Dr. Donna McIntyre, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. She is in Calgary on family matters.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Just to reiterate our group members, we have Alyssa Hamm, Eve Leduc, Salim Rufus-Spielt, Kantas Rankamar, and myself, Marilyn Abel. We'd like to thank you all for coming today. It gives us an opportunity that we're happy to have to show you what we've been up to for the last year. The title of our project was The Role of Hip Abductor Strengthening in the Treatment of Patellofemoral Pain Syndrome. And Dr. Donna McIntyre was our supervisor. So this is an overview of what we'll be going through for our presentation. I'll be doing the introduction and the methods. From there, Eve will take you guys through the results, and Silas will do the discussion, and I'll come back to do the conclusion to bring everything together. So patellofemoral pain syndrome doesn't have a universally accepted definition. However, the most common definition is retropatellar or peripatellar pain of insidious onset in the absence of other diagnosed pathological conditions. So it describes a spectrum of orthopedic abnormalities. This is the most common diagnosis of knee pain in active adults and adolescents, as it affects 1 in 4 of the population, with females being more affected than males. There's a large impact on the life of patients with patellofemoral pain, as it's exacerbated by prolonged sitting and repetitive weight-bearing activities. So as you can imagine, this impacts their quality of life, as they're no longer able to participate in the exercise and sports that they wish. As well, there may be an economic burden due to the medical cost of interventions and potential days off from work. It's difficult to determine the etiology of PFPS, and therefore it's considered multifactorial. The main current theory is patellar maltracking within a femoral trochlear notch caused by abnormal muscular or biomechanical forces. Several contributing factors have been identified for PFPS, such as an increased Q angle, hypermobile patella, patellas resting in different positions, and weak quadriceps, as well as decreased flexibility of muscles in the lower extremity. Several potential mechanisms for patellar maltracking have been proposed, with the first being the vastus lateralis being stronger and or activating prior to the vastus medialis obliquus. This will make the patella track laterally in the trochlear notch of the femur. The second potential mechanism is weak hip abductors, which would allow excessive femoral internal rotation and adduction of the femur underneath of the patella, creating relative lateral distraction of the patella and therefore increasing patellofemoral joint pressures and wear on the articular cartilage and altering the kinematics of the lower extremity. During our search, we found a relevant systematic review which looked into the strength of hip abductors in patients with patellofemoral pain syndrome. This review looked at 5 studies that measured hip strength in females who had patellofemoral pain syndrome and concluded that females with PFPS do show a decreased strength in hip abduction as well as external rotation and extension when compared to healthy controls. So we have a nice visual graphic here to show you the mechanism of weak hip abductors. So there's weak hip musculature, which then leads to increased femoral internal rotation and adduction, causing relative lateral movement of the patella and knee pain due to increased patellofemoral contact pressures. Research has been done into the kinematics of patients with PFPS, and there's been conflicting results. As we know so far, there are about 4 articles have looked into kinematics. 2 have found that people with PFPS do have increased internal femoral rotation and adduction, where 2 other studies have not. However, those 2 studies have had methodological issues been identified. So increased hip abduction angle was found in a prolonged run in one of the studies, and the other studies found increased femoral internal rotation with PFPS during functional movements such as squatting and running. So the purpose of our systematic review is to investigate the role of strengthening hip abduction in the treatment of PFPS, because traditionally the knee musculature has been the role and the focus of treatment. So we feel that investigation of the hip abductors needs to be done. This leads to our question, is hip abductor strengthening an effective component of PFPS treatment? Now I'm going to move on to the methods that we conducted in order to help answer this question. The operational definition we used for patellofemoral pain syndrome was anterior or retropatellar pain not associated with other identifiable pathological conditions. This is an example of our search strategy that we used for Medline. As you can see, see if I can get the arrow, lines 1 to 14 are terms for patellofemoral pain syndrome. 16 to 25 are intervention and treatment terms, and then lines 27 to 31 are terms we use to isolate the hip. This is a flowchart of included and excluded studies from each of our databases and the flow at which it was done at the different levels of title and abstract and full text screening. We searched, as well as Medline, we searched Cinahl, Embase, Pedro, and Sports Discus. We also did a search of the gray literature, which included Google, Google Scholar, Papers First, and ProQuest dissertation and thesis. The selected articles were also scanned to find their references and to select any relevant references that may help us with our search. We also contacted authors in the field for additional information on data or studies that may have yet been unpublished. Once we had our articles, we had two reviewers do the screening. In case of disagreement, the two reviewers would meet to have consensus, and third-party mediation was not needed. This was a screening tool we used for each of the levels. You can see we have title, abstract, and full text review. At the bottom is our inclusion criteria, which was subjects clinically diagnosed with PFPS, that specific hip abductor strengthening was part or whole of the intervention, that the intervention was a minimum of 4 weeks with 2 to 3 days per week, and that pain and hip abductor strength was used as outcome measures, and that comparisons were able to be drawn regarding the use of hip abductor strengthening as an effective component of treatment, and studies published in English, French, or German as those languages are spoken amongst our group, or members of our group can speak those languages. Exclusion criteria were subjects with recent knee injuries in addition to patellofemoral pain, as well as subjects with additional knee pathologies such as osteoarthritis or iliotibial band syndrome. After we did our screen, we did quality assessment using Pedro, and we used a similar process to that of our screening where we had two reviewers go through the process, meet for consensus if there's discrepancies, and again, third-party mediation was not needed. Once the quality assessment was completed, we moved on to data analysis. A data extraction tool was created and used to collate the relevant data, and again, done by two reviewers and compared for consistency. And it was not necessary for the authors of these articles to be contacted for missing information. Okay, now I'm going to move you guys on to Eve, where he will discuss our results.
So only three articles were found to be eligible out of 182 articles. The articles that were excluded based on these three main points. If they lacked intervention, since we were looking at treatment, some articles focused on a relationship between patients with PFPS and weak abductors, but without treatment. Also, articles were excluded if they had intervention that were not specific to the hip musculature. And finally, if they were focused on other knee pathologies. We had auto alerts set up with Medline, Sports Discus, Embase, and Cinahl. And out of that, we actually got one article that went to full text and is included in this review. And we ended our search strategy July 20th, 4 days ago. Those are the three articles that were selected. Mescal and colleagues, 2003, Management of Patellofemoral Pain Targeting Hip, Pelvis, and Trunk Muscle Function, 2 case reports. Tyler and colleagues in 2006, the role of hip muscle function in the treatment of PFPS. And finally, Nakagawa and colleagues in 2008, the effect of additional strengthening of hip abductor and lateral rotator muscles in PFPS, a randomized controlled pilot study. The Mescal study was the first one to assess the role of the hip musculature in treating PFPS. And they basically focused on strengthening the hip musculature, specifically glute max, glute med, the hip abductors, and the external rotators. And they found decrease in pain, but also improved biochemical kinematics while assessing with a step-down exercise, and specifically decrease in hip adduction and femoral internal rotation. In 2006, the Tyler study followed, and they focused on strengthening the hip flexors, abductors, and adductor muscle groups, but also stretching the hip flexors and the IT band. Although they found an increase in hip abductor strength, they didn't find this to be significant. And the reason for that was this: although they didn't have a control group, they did an end-of-study analysis by splitting up their patients at the end between successful and unsuccessful outcomes. And they found that there was no statistical significance, that both groups basically had an increase in hip abduction. They attributed the decrease in symptoms to combined iliocellular strengthening, lengthening, along with IT band lengthening. The Nakagawa study was the only RCT that we have. They had all of their patients in the control and intervention group strengthen their quads, but the intervention group, in addition, had hip abductor and external rotator strengthening. They found decrease in pain and functional activities, but they weren't able to identify which of these two muscle groups, the abductor or external rotators, had a greater contribution in the reduction of symptoms. They also found increase in hip eccentric external rotation and hip abduction torque, but they found that to be not statistically significant, but clinically significant. And they explained that by arguing that they were statistically insignificant due to the short sample size and short treatment time, but that even though they couldn't measure appreciable amount of hip external rotation and hip abduction strength change, that the patients experienced increased hip motor control, and that could lead to decrease in symptoms. Quality assessment was done with the Pedro scale, as you know, is out of 10, with three in, or below three a low quality, and above five being a high quality. And if you just focus on the column on the right, you can see our studies go from 3, 5, and 9. So we only had one that was of high quality. And since we didn't really have that many studies that came out of our search, the low Pedro score was not an exclusion criteria for this review. So the common trend from this PICO table was that they all had similar baseline groups. They measured at least one key outcome in 85% of the subjects. They provided treatment or control conditions to all of their subjects. But however, none of the studies blinded their therapist providing the treatment. The data extraction, there was too much heterogeneity between the studies, so we couldn't do a quantitative analysis. So we did a qualitative analysis, and we pulled the result in a table under the PICO headings, population, intervention, comparison, and outcome. And there's the table here. And this gave us an overview of all three papers so that we can sort of see for emerging themes. The Mascal paper in the intervention was 14 weeks with clinical visits and home exercise program, focusing, as I've said before, glute max, med, external rotators mainly. Main outcomes, muscle strength and pain. The Tyler study was a 6-week intervention, similar setup with clinical visits and home exercise program, hip flexor, abductor, and adductor strengthening. Main key outcomes, muscle strength, pain, but also flexibility. And finally, the Nakagawa study was also a 6 weeks treatment. Similar structure, clinic visits, a home exercise program. Everyone had quad strengthening, but only the intervention group had transverse abdominis, hip abductors, and external rotators. And their main outcome was also pain and muscle strength. This is a table that shows how the hip strength was measured in the three studies. It's really there mainly to show you how it was relatively inconsistent between the three studies. If you look at the fourth column from the left in muscle action, you can see that both the Tyler and Mascal measured muscle strength using a break test, which is an end-of-range isometric max hold, whereas the Nakagawa study used a make test, which is an isokinetic through range. Also, each study used different types of dynamometer and used them on different hip muscles and in different positions. So this made the comparison between the studies relatively difficult, but we nevertheless tried. This is the hip strength outcome. It's expressed as percent change. So all the values there are percent increase in strength. So As you can see, the Tylers, like as explained before, divided their group between successful and unsuccessful outcome at the end of the study, and they compared the strength in their case between hip abduction and hip flexor strength. However, the only variable that we can compare across the board is hip abduction strength. Similar table, this time for pain, expressed it's using the visual analog scale expressed in percentage. All three studies found a decrease in pain, so all the values are negative. However, as you can see, there was no one activity that was compared in all three studies. So they used the visual analog scale, but for different things. This also made comparison difficult. So from that table, the visual analog scale was used in the Nakagawa study for squatting and prolonged sitting, Mescal for walking, Tyler for ADLs and exercise. Now, interestingly, all three studies did assess or look at the presence of pain using stairs, but Tyler didn't use the visual analog scale for some reason. They used a yes-no questionnaire, which precluded them from analysis of the data. Overall, though, the pain decreased significantly in the Mescal and Nakagawa study, also in the Tyler, but a little less. And now Silas is going to lead you through the discussion.
Thanks, Eve. So before we delve into the discussion, I just wanted to reacquaint everyone with the aim of our systematic review. The purpose of our SR was to investigate whether patients with PFPS could effectively benefit from hip abductor strengthening to reduce their associated PFPS symptoms. Our qualitative review concluded that there's a limited amount of clinical research supporting this theory presently. The bottom line, further research is required to help clarify the role that hip muscle strengthening for certain PFPA, that hip muscle strengthening plays within certain PFPS populations. All three studies selected were motivated by a similar theoretical framework and treatment premise for PFPS. As Marilyn already discussed in our introduction, the underlying mechanism of this theoretical framework is that the lack of hip control and or weak hip musculature may lead to excessive femoral internal rotation and adduction under the patella. This kinematic dysfunction may lead to then a relative lateral distraction of the patella, increase the patellofemoral joint stress, and eventually wear on the articular cartilage and alter lower extremity kinematics. And this can be seen again as illustrated in the diagram at the bottom right of this slide. Current treatment approaches supporting this theoretical framework, as seen in the selected three studies, was focusing on the role that hip musculature plays with respect to femoral movement control. An emerging trend seen in all three studies was that chronological progressive improvement in quality of study design, as listed below, Mescal's case study in 2003, Tyler's cohort study of 2006, and then Nakagawa's 2008 publication of his RCT. Also to note is that Nakagawa did make reference and mention both Tyler and Mescal's studies in his research body of work. Based on our qualitative assessment, only two comparable outcomes were measurable, increase in changes in hip abductor strength and changes in pain. Although hip abductor strength increased as a result of each of the respective treatment protocols in all three studies, only Mescal and colleagues and Nakagawa and colleagues concluded and connected the combination of increased hip muscle strength, that of abductors and external rotators, and the increase in motor control as being responsible for the improvements of lower extremity kinematics. In contrast, Tyler and colleagues stated that the hip abductor strengthening was not clinically relevant. Hisu went on to suggest that the other hip musculature, the combination that we talked about in Eve's results section, that of ilioso strengthening, lengthening, and ITB lengthening, to actually be responsible for the femoral internal rotation seen in his study. Looking at the changes in pain recorded, again, Mescal, colleagues, and Nakagawa and colleagues alleged that the hip abductor and external rotator strength improvements did explain the changes, as we just saw in the previous slide, in the hip kinematics and subsequent pain reduction associated with the PFPS symptoms. Conversely, Tyler and colleagues' study implicated, again, a different set of musculature, the combination of ilioso strengthening, lengthening, and ITB lengthening, being responsible for arriving at the same conclusion of pain reduction associated with PFPS symptoms. Even though core strengthening and motor control were both integrated in the respective treatment protocols of all three studies, these variables were not specifically evaluated, nor were they tabulated in any of the included articles. The problem with this is that the possible increases in core strength and hip motor control may actually have contributed to the decrease of PFPS symptoms and were not adequately controlled for within their study designs. Some limitations did arise in our systematic review, but I'm sure you guys can guess. First off, there was a small number of studies available to us to analyze. Secondly, there was only a total of 51 participants studied in all three studies combined, which may have limited the conclusions that we could make based on the resulting data. Furthermore, the heterogeneity between the included articles made analysis and comparison a bit more difficult and may also have resulted in some of the themes being overlooked and not identified and included within our discussion. To address these limitations that arose out of our SR, we have come up with a few recommendations for future study parameters. First off, we would like to see more RCTs being conducted with increased sample sizes and performing longitudinal studies inclusive of short, medium, and long-term follow-up periods in order to determine whether successful outcomes were sustained and whether recurrences, if occur in PFPS symptoms, were due to muscle length or muscle strength. In addition, exercise protocols with core strengthening and hip motor control exercise need to be assigned to both control and intervention groups. And finally, differentiation for hip external rotation, extension, and abduction musculature needs to be addressed in future study design protocols. Next, Marilyn will conclude our presentation.
Thanks, Silas. So our plans for the information that we have revealed from our systematic review is to disseminate it to Physiotherapy Canada, as it's distributed to a large population of our peers, as well as it will reach physiotherapists across different domains, as I feel this could be helpful for maybe a pediatric population as well as an adult population. In conclusion, present research does not conclusively identify the benefits of hip abductor strengthening for PFPS treatment. However, we still feel that we have good clinical application from our results. Patellofemoral pain patients present with unique biomechanical dysfunctions, one of which may be the excessive femoral internal rotation and adduction, which may be due to multiple hip muscles. So if a patient presents to your clinic with insidious knee pain, make sure you do a thorough assessment of the hip as well as the knee in order to determine the cause of pain and therefore the best course of treatment. We're not saying that the knee no longer plays a role in PFPS, but make sure that you assess both joints to identify which is relevant for that patient. At this time, we'd like to have a special thanks out to Donna McIntyre for guiding us and leading us through this process. Charlotte Beck for her invaluable help during our search process. Dr. Darlene Lee for introducing to us how to do a systematic review. Dr. Elizabeth Dean for carrying on that torch and organizing the symposium for us, as well as to our peers sitting here in the audience. It's been very fun working with you guys since this program has started. Thank you. At this time, we welcome questions from the audience.
I noticed you guys included chondromalacia in your chondromalacia patella in your search strategy, and I know PFPS is a syndrome and therefore a collection of symptoms, but I'm wondering if you had participants in your included studies that had other diagnosed knee problems.
That was an exclusion criteria for each of the three articles in our review.
So why did you include chondromalacia?
Because it sometimes is a synonymous term in other research.
Okay.
It can be used interchangeably. So that's why we included it, because we did realize there could be a lack of research. So we kind of opened it up a bit and found other synonymous terms. Oh boy.
A few of the studies, or you mentioned hip motor control. And I was wondering did the studies actually measure that, and if they did, how did they do that?
Hip motor control wasn't actually measured. It was always a suggestion as to maybe why there was improvements. Although Mascal, he did measure hip motor control using Shirley Sharman's techniques, which I'm not that familiar with. So there were certain aspects there that he used to measure hip motor control that I'm not very familiar with.
But largely it was just kind of assumed that they would improve their motor control as well as improve the strength and whether or not one was more responsible.
Yeah, and it was always a suggestion because it wasn't thoroughly investigated and measured.
But the Tyler study based partly their intervention structure based on Mascal study and so on, and then the Nakagawa. And if you go through the Mascal study, they're very thorough in describing the whole, not only what exactly the patients had to do in terms of exercise, but what they had to successfully control before they move on to a higher level, like non-weight-bearing, weight-bearing, and so on. And so you could tell that they were really also focused on making sure they had their TA control and, you know, the positions were right. So it wasn't specifically measured.
Right.
But it was an assumption that these people gained internal, let's say, awareness and control.
Just wondering how, or if the studies looked at the influence of footwear or the influence of the foot in terms of controlling between studies.
Nakagawa did provide footwear for each of the patients, so they were having the same footwear. I think it was Nakagawa, or maybe it was another study.
It was the group.
Yeah. Other than that, no. But some of the research I read on kinematics, they did look at like pronation and such in the foot, but not relevant to footwear.
Our background studies that we looked at, they did, but none of the included studies did.
Mascal talked about some type of a dynamic or biomechanical assessment within a step down, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Now, was that done through, say, digitized video through a software package so that they could get representative torques and angles at different joints?
It was a case based, so they only had two patients, and they only did that with one.
Oh, okay.
And then report it, and it was all with the, you know, the little light bulbs and so on.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
3D dimensional.
Could I follow that up with why they only did that with one patient and then came up with a conclusion that the conclusion that they did?
No.
Nope.
They didn't justify why they did it with just one patient. However, with both of the subjects, they did an observational analysis during a 10-meter walk test. So they were doing an observational gait analysis during walking and step down. So they were observationally seeing it, and then that one subject underwent the analysis.
So with that qualitative gait assessment, did they use a standardized tool or anything like that to assess the gait?
Not that they mentioned.
Just observational, and that was seen also with Nakagawa's study and also other research outside of the included articles. Would continue to reference Mascal's one single.
Okay.
And I think clinically that's relevant, right? Because we're not going to have access to the technology. So that was part of our clinical implication, was making sure you do a full assessment to see if there is femoral issues. Harry?
I feel so nervous this morning. I'm like, take a deep breath. Based on what you guys found over the SR, what would you say would be like a clinical message for us to treat PFPS and to increase the hip and upper strength, like parameter-wise?
Well, I think, like we said in our last point, you have to make sure, like if someone presents with unilateral knee pain, compare hip muscle strength side to side and see if there's any imbalances and not just looking at quad strength or feet. So basically just doing the assessment and looking to see where the imbalances are or where the weaknesses are and focus treatment towards that, and then see what kind of outcomes you get. Because again, each person with PFPS is completely unique as to what is causing their pain. Some may be the traditional VL-VMO imbalance, and that works for them, but the ones that doesn't work for, it's often a cause of hip or foot. Whereas our research was focused on the hips, that's all we didn't really focus into the foot and ankle, but we know that it can play a role as well. So it's just basically gathering all the information and tailoring each treatment specific to that person's assessment. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Kate, did you have a question?
Yeah, did Tyler in his study say, sort of explain his rationale behind the hip flexor strengthening improving the lower extremity kinematics?
They speculated that the hip flexor plays a secondary role in hip femoral external rotation. and that a stronger hip flexor may prevent excessive internal rotation. And in addition to that, they argue that if you have a tight hip flexor and a tight IT band, that may provoke anterior pelvic tilt, which may lead into femoral internal rotation. That's their rationale for that. Yeah. It's very statistically and clinically significant with regards to the results of increased strength and length and so on. And the fact that the patients that had most success were the ones that had all three improvements. And had, you know, the ones that had only two variables had it was a small percentage and so on.
All three being the hip flexor strength and length
and IT band length.
But not the abductors.
Not abductors.
Because all subjects had increasing hip abductor strength, but not all had decrease of symptoms. And his theory with regards to iliopsoas and hip flexors is his theory, as there is no reference behind it in this article.
Do you think as a rotator, as a control of rotators, there are lots of muscles that could be more effective?
And yeah, also the anterior pelvic tilts.
I kind of have a two-parter.
And
surprise. But at the same time, you might not be able to answer, but I just kind of want to know that considering pain is the common theme throughout the syndrome, obviously it's in the name, but was it ever addressed in any of the methods that you saw, i.e. pain education, chronic pain management, or fear avoidance behaviors being measured? Was any of that ever seen in any of your studies?
No.
Not in the three included.
Okay.
The research I did on the kinematics research, they do mention that some of the patterns seen may be due to pain avoidance. That's about it.
So do you think that something like pain management or measuring and kind of seeing how fear avoidance behaviors change after treatment would be something to later include in studies? Like, would that be something that needs to be added on to this type of research?
I think in the future, that would be a great addition, but at this point, I really think they need to focus on the role of the hip abductors. As that link has been created, but it's not a very strong link. But I think pain and chronic pain issues would be a great addition.
You guys mentioned that this might be able to sort of go into pediatric practice as well. Do you guys know how common it is for the pediatric population to have PFPS? Or did you just number it?
No, I didn't see any research on that. I just thought personally that it could be an issue. As I know personally and with Alyssa, we were having PFPF symptoms as teenagers, and even younger. So I just thought by disseminating to Physiotherapy Canada, we kind of cover all the areas of practice.
With a lot of females, it does start in their preteens, and as they start developing preteens.
I had a question related to that as well in terms of the age of the, you mentioned that most of them were female. But what was the age range in the studies?
We have Artina Pico.
So this was, we have a larger table of, so this was the graph that was in our presentation is just a condensed form of our PICO here. So this one will show our age groups. So they ranged from
17 was the youngest.
Yeah, so teenagers up into middle adults or middle age.
And that was an exclusion criteria for some of the studies was age, considering the incidence of osteoarthritis and other changes after a certain age. They wanted to exclude those factors from the study.
And do these studies, and in your reading, it looks like the etiology has been associated with, it seems, either excessive sitting, sedentary lifestyle, as well as perhaps the opposite of repetitive weight bearing. Number one, was that distinguished in any of these studies or in any other studies that you read? And number two, do you believe that has any implication for the manifestation of the pain and how it might be?
Well, I think it's like Louise said, the multifactorial as to how it manifests, whether it's a muscle imbalance or if it's a biomechanical, if it's a Q angle, if it's the foot. But
in most cases, the symptoms are exacerbated by prolonged sitting, just having the knee in that situation, or going, usually it's descending stairs is also an exacerbation, or prolonged running. So it's not necessarily that prolonged sitting leads to CFPS, it's just something that exacerbates the symptoms. So it's still unknown as to the exact cause, because it can be so many different things.
And you, and coming back to this, the issue of the going downstairs, and it looks like that that was used as a test, a challenge test. Is there a test that's standardized for going downstairs?
Step down.
Well, the step down test, but it's just doing one step down. I guess that, you know, that could be different. You could, different, you can argue, from having somebody come down 30 steps and then you have muscle endurance issues, right? So, but there's no standardization at this point. I think it's partly because it's a syndrome and there can be so potential many causes.
Both the Mascal and the Tyler use 8-inch steps, but I think that was just a coincidence. There's no actual standardized step. And in the Mascal study, patient A had pain with going descending from one stair, like, and then 10 out of 10 pain for doing a whole flight of stairs pre-test or pre-treatment. So I think that even though they do, like, they have these symptoms with just doing it like a single step, they with, I think with most of these activities, with the longer they are in duration, the more with fatigue, then you start to break down your actual positioning and your kinematics, so their symptoms are worse, longer activity.
But it sounds like this could be a nice little research project for someone to develop a test, a simple standardized test, involving, do they hold on, do they not hold on, what's the size of the step, all those things that when you do an aerobic step test could be done there to, as a challenge test. Could be very useful, I think, to provide the right outcome.
Yeah, it would be one of many for PFPS, because some people with PFPS don't have pain descending stairs. It's sitting, or it's going upstairs.
That's right. Or so, exactly. Squatting.
Yeah. Or squatting.
Maybe you could do both, but we have to be on separate days. That triggered another thought, too, running the test.
Oh. Alex has a question if you want to gather that up.
Yes, I will.
Sorry, we were talking. The word strengthening keeps coming up between the studies and that they showed increased strength. So what I'm wondering is, I think it's plausible based on the first two studies used an isometric end range hold. So if you think of the length tension relationship, that falls somewhere between the concentric and eccentric side of things. So it gets sort of that nice happy middle in terms of strength. But did these studies actually follow what we would think to be a traditional strengthening parameters with a high amount of load and a low number of repetitions and going to that instantaneous sort of muscle fatigue where they truly can't do another repetition? Or were they more actually looking at the endurance, motor control side of it?
They were assessing more eccentric hip strengthening, but none of the studies ever actually specified the number of reps and sets that they did. They said that for progression, they had to be able to do two sets of 15 reps, but nothing about how many they actually did specifically within each.
Okay, so Mescal's the only one that mentioned that, and based on that idea, it sounds like they were more towards an endurance component than a true muscle strength component of the intervention.
Is there another question?
In your inclusion criteria, you mentioned a minimum, like exercise with a minimum of 4-week duration. I'm just wondering how you came to the 4-week number and how many studies were excluded based on that number.
There was one study that was more of a case report that had two patients, I think it was one or two patients that came in, but they were only treated over a course of less than 2 weeks. And by ACSM guidelines, you need at least, like, that's where we got the 4 weeks, 2-3 times a week to see a change in strength. So we figured if they were seen, if they didn't have that time, then we need to have a true strength gain rather than improved like recruitment of muscle fibers that can happen in that first time period. So we wanted to make sure it was a true muscle strengthening.
A couple of final thoughts. As I was thinking about the step test, I was thinking about side dominance. What is the relationship? Because you could argue perhaps that that could be protective, or it could lead to the potential overuse that you've described. Any information? And if not, how would you hypothesize?
On the Nakagawa study, what they did is they, in the control group, they as a comparative limb to the PFPS patients, they used the weaker limb on assuming, you know, making an assumption between the weaker limb of the control group and the PFPS. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't really a correlation that was attempted with the REMS.
There was no mention to leg dominance and thus being a stronger leg or not.
Do you think body weight is implicated in
that? Mascal actually did do BMI of the two participants, and one of the participants was considered overweight due to her BMI. The other articles make no mention of the body weight, just that the Nakagawa, the control group, I do believe they had similar. But I personally think it plays a role as well as sedentary lifestyle.
And finally, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, padlectomies were done a lot for children. And from what I understand and read, it was believed that kids were sitting on their knees, you know, back on their knees all the time, and that this created undue strain and laxity of ligaments and so on and so forth, and ultimately pain and discomfort. And padlectomies were done, you know, at the drop of a hat. Do you have any information about that? You know, then it went out of style, and I don't know. But that obviously has created some, you know, structural changes for those people who've lived with the absence of their one or more patella.
I didn't see anything.
Never heard of that before today.
Yeah.
Well, it's true.
Yeah.
Any remaining questions?
Yeah, sorry. Is PFPS more common in like the athletic population or just like a recreational athlete or sedentary, like overweight? Any information? Like, I wasn't focused.
Yeah. It was kind of across the board. Like, we did see a lot of studies, but none that compared different activity levels. But the terms are thrown out there, active population, sedentary population, but never consistently. So, yeah, there didn't seem to be a consensus.
And no association with hyperextension.
Yeah, I didn't see anything on that.
I was just going to say, in the case study, the two people, one was someone who wanted to return to running, whereas the other one was relatively, the one that was a little more overweight, was a relatively sedentary person. So for them, anyway, they didn't differentiate.
Sorry if you already mentioned this, but did you say that PFPS is more common in females?
Yes.
Do you know, or any suggestion?
Theoretical argument has to do with increased Q angle, and
as well as potential hormonal issues that weren't ever specified, the structural being Q angle and potential hormonal.
That being said, they haven't really established a link between static Q angle and PFPS. They speculate that it's more of the temporary dynamic increase of the Q angle, like in a step down and things like that. Same thing for the internal rotation of the femur. It's a temporary excessive. Due to some weak muscles.
You know, in this discussion, which obviously relates to the knee, and you brought in the hip, and of course that's the focus of the systematic review, but you haven't mentioned the back, and you know, this being predominantly in female, and the fact that women are more prone to scoliosis, has there, what's your thought about that influencing the kinematics of the knee?
Mascal actually did a very thorough assessment of the two subjects in this case study and did do an L-spine assessment and found no indication of anything there. But other than that, I didn't see any other mention to back or L-spine.
During their interventions, they mentioned, like both in Mascal and Tyler, that they weren't, that they really emphasized having like a neutral pelvis as they did the exercises, but never anything specific to that.
Thank you. Good, thank you very much.